Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to be talking with you to begin the show about the latest research going on to help preserve and restore vision. And our guest knows a whole lot about that. Dr. David Gamm is director of the McPherson Eye Research Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. They're doing some great things. His own clinical practice is in pediatric ophthalmology. His research focuses on human retinal development and disease. So we'll talk about some of the latest advancements in, age-related macular degeneration, that's one. We can talk about glaucoma, diabetic retinopathy, and childhood onset disorders. And, of course, we'll take your questions about eyesight and eye health as well as we move along, and I hope you'll join in. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Dr. David Gamm, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us.
Thank you, Larry. Always good to be back.
Yeah, good to have you back. What are some of the, let's go with some of the basics first here. What are some of the most common causes of blindness or vision loss?
So tops on the list would be glaucoma, age-related macular degeneration, diabetic retinopathy. Those are very large ones. Those are all diseases that have, for the most part, few treatments when they get to bad stages. Of course, if you look at globally for vision loss, there are things like cataracts, which are easily addressed here in the Western world, but in other places are still a real problem.
Yeah, they're an awful problem. And just as an aside, I know there have been some doctors at the University of Wisconsin who have done a lot of wonderful work around in other parts of the world helping blind people see.
Yeah, the University of Wisconsin is kind of on the forefront on doing outreach and international missions. And I go to to Central America myself, and a number of our physicians go to countries around the world, India, Philippines.
Yeah, for sure. Well, what conditions lead to blindness or vision loss? And
Some of the things that we concentrate on in the Institute, so for instance, we don't concentrate very, very highly on cataracts because we have really good treatments right now.
Yeah.
So we try to position ourselves to battle the conditions that have plagued humankind since the dawn of time, for which there really are no treatments or poor treatments. And so a lot of times that comes down to degenerative diseases, diseases that affect the cells in the eye that are critical for vision, but do not replace themselves if they're injured or subject to, say, genetic disease. So retinitis pigmentosa would be one of those that affects the photoreceptors, the light-sensing cells in the back of the eye. Age-related macular degeneration also affects those cells and their helper cells called the retinal pigment epithelium. And then also kind of more superficial in the retina, there are other cells that transmit all the information that the retina gathers and sends it back to the brain. Those are called ganglion cells, and those are affected in glaucoma and optic neuropathies and things like that. And so for the most part, those are diseases that when they get to a certain stage, there's really nothing we can offer for them. And so the Institute is dedicated to looking at those problems in particular and filling in the gaps. And they're huge gaps, and they affect millions of people worldwide. And we want them to be able to turn to something and hopefully things that we can play a part in developing.
And, you know, I was really interested in the research that you're doing, and not that I know anything about it and want to learn about it today, as the use of stem cells to develop therapies with stem cells.
Yeah, and this is something that I started after I finished my residency here now 15, 16 years ago. And, of course, it was a natural thing to look into since the University of Wisconsin-Madison is essentially a mecca for stem cell research worldwide. And so the two areas of stem cell research that are really applicable to the diseases that we're interested in the Institute, one is not necessarily making the cells to put back into patients directly, but we have the capacity now, we developed it here at UW-Madison, to create unlimited supplies of human retina from patients that have any disease. And by doing that, we can better understand why those patients lost vision, and you'd be surprised how often we don't know that. And if we don't know the reason why they lost vision, it's hard to envision ways to intervene and stop, halt, or reverse that. We also then can use that unlimited supply of human retinas to test therapies like gene therapies or drugs or nutritional interventions to see how it affects the course of that disease. And it, that knowledge then can be conveyed back to the patient. However, if you're in the later stages of any of these diseases where there's no longer cells left to save or a disease left to reverse, then you're looking at replacing parts. And so that's where the stem cell biology can be a source of replacement parts in the retina. And we've been on the forefront of that, and we're now very close to starting clinical trials to help patients in late stages.
Wow. So you would be able to inject stem cells into a patient and hopefully...
That's the idea. It's kind of a simple mechanical way of thinking about it, right? So you have, so the retina itself, so the retina is the kind of the film in the back of the camera, the film in the back of your eye, and it's it looks very kind of like a cellophane, but it's actually a very complex transparent layer cake with multiple cell types that have to interact with each other in a very particular way. And the diseases that we mentioned, they pinpoint or target certain of those cells and cause them to die over time. And just like you're missing a part in your car engine. And so for forever, until the advent of stem cell technology, there was no way to get those replacement parts. Now we can make them, and they're authentic. They're real human replacement parts for the retina, and we can make them an unlimited supply. The next step is installation. So you got the manufacturer of the part, and now how do you get it back into not only a human eye, but in a diseased human eye? So that eye has undergone a lot of change, right? So trying to get those new pieces to hook up and work with the old pieces is still a challenge. And that goes back to how you manufacture the replacement parts, how you deliver them, how do you prepare the diseased retina to accept those new parts. But those are all steps in along the way that we're making good progress on.
Compared to even 10 years ago, I think there's been a lot.
Tremendous. 10 years ago, we just started getting an inkling that we could make the parts, but we didn't know how close they were. Were they real ducks or were they wooden ducks, you know?
Yeah.
And in this case, close doesn't count. You have to be, you know, these are some of the most highly specialized, if not the most highly specialized cells in your entire body. They do specific jobs and they need specific parts to them in order to behave properly. Otherwise, we're just going through the motions of putting something in somebody's eye, which could be potentially harmful, right? So we want to make sure that there's a capacity to improve their condition. So we spent the next number of years being sure that the cells that we were making were actually bona fide human photoreceptor cells, light sensing cells. And then more recently, it's been how do we convert that kind of onerous manual task of creating these spare parts into something that's more on the order of Detroit's manufacturing lines, right? So that we can make enough of them and make them hopefully cheap enough where we can offer them to anybody.
Your research has focused on pediatric ophthalmology, so you work with kids a lot. What are some of the most common concerns when it comes to children's vision and eye health?
So from what's common, by far the most important and potentially permanent visual problem that children can develop is something called amblyopia. And amblyopia is commonly referred to as lazy eye.
Yeah.
And that can occur either because one eye is inherently weaker in its ability to focus light and to provide clear images to the brain, or it could be because the eye isn't necessarily straight, right? In both cases, that can be fixed. And if we get to kids early enough while they're still visually mature, because you learn to see like you learn to walk and you learn to talk. So there's a period of time in your early development where your brain is paying attention to what your eyes do. And if they don't do a very good job, the brain figures out it can do something else with itself. And so it'll check out. That can be reversed if you're still in an early age. A lot of what we do is do surveillance for that and do surgeries to correct the alignment of an eye or do patching or other things to try to strengthen eyes that are otherwise weak. So that's an area that we do have really good interventions for, and it's being able to pick them up that's important.
And when you talk about early enough, what are you?
that's actually an evolving topic as well. Oh. When I started 15, 18 years ago, there was this dogma of age 7, right? But we all know there's not It's not, you don't flip a switch at age seven, all of a sudden you're hardwired, right? So more recent research suggests that you can intervene even into your early teens and maybe a little bit later, but think of it like cement hardening. So when you first pour the cement, it's very, you know, very fluid. And the metaphor I like to use with my patients is trying to set a basketball pole in cement. So when it's really early on, that before it hardens, it can move around a lot. So you can straighten it out if it's crooked, and it can go crooked if it's straight. But then as it starts to solidify, then it's harder to move things. And so, and eventually it is hardwired and set in place. And so our job is to make sure that that basketball pole is as straight close as to straight arrow. As possible when it hardens.
Dr. David Gamm, our guest today. Isn't this fascinating? He's the director of the McPherson Eye Research Institute at the University of Wisconsin. I'm talking with him a bit about his research, stem cell research. We're talking vision loss and eye health with him. And you may have some questions for him. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. And you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Tyler Ditter, our engineer today, Jane Rotunda, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at your eyes today here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. David Gamm, who directs the McPherson Eye Research Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Questions for him, give us a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And one of the reasons we wanted to have him on now is because there's something called the annual Cycle for Sight event. It's coming up on March 9th, and I'll have him talk some more about it. I was a participant last year, I will be doing it again this year. At least I'll be contributing some money toward it. And so we'll talk about that with him as well. We have an email from Franny who says, I wear my dailies toric lenses for up to 3 days, taking them out each night and soaking them in disinfecting solution overnight. Is this dangerous to my eye health?
So the key there is that you take them out every night. There are some contact lenses that are purported to be okay to sleep in overnight, but that is not the case. There is no safe contact lens to wear overnight. You absolutely raise your risk for corneal ulcers and infections if you do that. So in this case, if you're wearing them up to 3 days but taking them out every night, then you should be fine.
So it shouldn't be a problem with a disinfecting solution overnight.
No, I wear contacts myself. I'm wearing them right now. I disinfect them every night. Yes, we like disinfection. Disinfection is good. Just don't do it with your household cleaners. Use the right stuff.
PJ emailed, I've been going to yoga class weekly for about 14 years, and a couple of years ago I started noticing something strange. When I'm doing upside down poses, I kind of have double vision, mainly involving the lights in the ceiling. Apparently, yoga inversions can double eye pressure. Could the inversions be harming my eyes, or what could be going on with my, I guess, left eye? Is there something you should be seeing about this besides maybe a regular optometrist?
So first of all, double vision has to do with the registration between the two eyes. So having increased eye pressure in a single eye wouldn't cause double vision. That being said, you know, hanging upside down does increase eye pressure, but it's only during the time that you're hanging upside down. So unless you are planning on living the lifestyle of a sloth or something, I think you should be just fine. In terms of why do you see double when you're hanging upside down, that's most likely because most of us walk around with a subtle imbalance in the alignment of our eye that our brain is able to correct when we're alert and focused on things. Our brain makes small changes and sends impulses to our muscles of our eye to keep them straight. And when you're hanging upside down, that's harder for your brain to do. And so you probably just kind of have a subtle eye misalignment, which again just goes away when you revert yourself.
It's amazing what the brain will do. We had the head of the largest optics company in the world, the former head of it, and he was talking about glasses where you could have one glass for close looking reading and the other side for long distance, and the brain can actually, in many cases, not every time, but instantly adjusts learns to adjust.
Yeah, it's called monovision, and I can't do it.
Some people.
It drives me crazy. I'm 50 now, so I'm looking for ways not to have a bifocal. And I'll try this. This stinks.
It didn't work for you. Somebody called to just praise it. They loved it.
Yeah. My mom does it. She loves it.
Well, let's take a call here. Lisa in Janesville, it's your turn. Thanks for calling, Lisa. What's on your mind?
Well, I was diagnosed with Fuchs dystrophy about a year ago and given a prescription for an ointment that's put in my eyes, which I find burns my eyes. Is there anything else I can do for that?
Okay, so just to let the audience know here, so Fuchs dystrophy is a deterioration of the cells that line the inside part of your cornea, which is the clear dome that covers the front of your eye, that covers the colored part, the iris and the pupil. And so in some folks, those parts wear out early, just like we talked about earlier about cells in the retina. And if that happens, one of the prime things that those corneal endothelial cells do is they pump fluid out of your cornea and keep it nice and compact and clear so that the light passes through it. So if that breaks down, then the cornea can swell because there's not as good of fluid pumping out. And so the drops that you're being given are drops that have a certain osmolarity to it to suck water out from the surface as opposed to sucking it out from the back of the cornea, and that can sting. In terms of what else you can do to suck things out, there isn't a whole lot. I mean, the drops are the most conservative way to go about doing this. Ultimately, there are really good surgeries too to replace those cells. But for the time being, I would say that's probably your best bet.
There you go. Thank you so much, Lisa. Appreciate it. And Barbara in Kenosha, your turn. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I'm calling because my mother about 10 years ago had a macular hole in her eye, and when she went to get surgery on it, it got worse, and she can barely see, very like a pinhole, basically. And right now, she's been going to the ophthalmologist, and he's been putting shots in her eye monthly because there's like water on the eye, and they tell her, well, you know, this is genetic, and you should tell your kids to get this checked out every time they go get their eyes checked. So is there anything else I can do to stop this from happening to me?
Okay, so there's a little communication issue here because there's two different things that you talked about. Because a macular hole is generally occurs when the jelly that's in the center of the eye pulls forward and pops a little piece of the macula, which is the center part of the retina, off. That's a physical injury, and oftentimes that can be repaired. The other aspect of it that can be inherited and can be treated with shots in the eye and causes fluid or bleeding, that's macular degeneration. So it could be that your mother has both, but there are two different things that you're talking about. The macular hole usually can be fixed. Sometimes it cannot. And if it cannot, then that really falls under the purview of this type of things that we're doing at the Eye Institute to try to replace retina. For macular degeneration, that's a whole topic in and of itself, of course. We usually get into that. That's a deterioration of the kind of an outer helper part of the eye that allows blood vessels to kind of come in and bleed. That can run in families, just like height or diabetes or things like that can run in families. And so what we tell folks that have that in their families is, A, don't smoke. So smoking is definitely a risk factor for that occurring. Eating healthy. We do a lot of nutritional work. Julia Maris in the Institute is kind of a world leader in looking at nutrition to try to stave off macular degeneration. There are also vitamins that are sold, but they have not been shown to prevent the onset of a macular degeneration. They help a subset of people that already have it. But those sort of things are possible interventions. But a healthy lifestyle, eating well, not smoking is about the best thing you can do.
There we go. Thank you, Barbara, for calling. And let's take another call. Charlie in Middleton. Hi there. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call, Larry. About 12 years ago, I had a ciliary body melanoma, and it was treated with radioplaque. And subsequent to that, it wrinkled my retina. So I've been dealing with what I call ghosting, because one eye seems to be working against the other, because the signals being sent to my brain, I think, from my retina are slightly different. Is there anything that you can do about that?
Okay, so I'll step back a little bit and describe what's going on. So a melanoma is, people know what a melanoma is. It's generally it's a cancerous tumor. It occurs inside the eye as well. It's not the same thing as a skin melanoma exactly. And where you had it was in an area that surrounds the lens, so kind of towards the front part of the eye. These are very serious cancers that people get, and so they're treated very therapeutics that are pretty aggressive, and that can include radiation. They try to confine it to the tumor as much as possible, but just like radiation elsewhere in the body, there can be collateral effects as well. If it doesn't work, the next step sometimes is taking the eye out. So you always kind of have to look at, okay, what is your cup half full or cup half empty? You still have the eye, so that's a good thing. But the collateral damage that can occur is that retina in the back of the eye is very sensitive, and that radiation can cause it to pucker or otherwise change. And then you have a hard time. Your brain has one perfect image from one eye and then kind of one wrinkly image from the other eye. And it tries to reconcile that, but there's no way to overlap those two perfectly. And that's where the fight comes in. Essentially, it's something that people will get, I don't know how long you had this happen, but sometimes the brain will get used to it and it'll become less bothersome over time. If it's a continuous problem that really is affecting folks, then really the way to approach that is to try to blur the eye further, the vision in the eye, so that it's not competing with the good eye. Unfortunately, there isn't anything right now that we can do to iron out the retina and to get rid of those wrinkles.
No. And how long would you, let's say Charlie has had this issue going on for 6 months or maybe a year, is that the length of time you have to start thinking about?
Yeah,
the brain's not going to work here on.
Right, and this is not an uncommon problem. They'll come into my practice too, and the first thing I'll ask is, when did this all happen? And if it's only been a matter of months, I'll say, well, just keep at it. And the best thing you can do is try not to pay attention to it, because you can teach yourself to, be bothered by it, right? You can look for it, right? Where in a best case scenario, you're just going about your daily business and you're not even thinking about your vision, right? It's just doing its thing. So the more you can kind of just do your thing and try to avoid concentrating on it, the better off you are. If after a year or so it's still bothering you, then I think there's other interventions that have to be considered, including obscuring the vision in the offending eye.
Yeah, there we go, Charlie. Thank you so much for calling. Connie in Portage, on to you now. Hi, Connie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think he answered some things. I have macular degeneration, and I was wondering if there's anything new about macular degeneration. I'm getting shots in one eye. I have one wet and one dry, and my mother has had both eyes. And my sister has both eyes. So I was wondering if there's anything new,
Sure.
Or what are you working on? Yeah.
Yeah, sure. So the discussion of dry versus wet comes up all the time. I think that's important. So everybody has dry macular degeneration. The question is whether you develop wet on top of that. Dry is the slow kind of smoldering forest fire that occurs in the center of the retina that slowly deteriorates those light-sensing cells in the back of the eye. As that happens, and as those cells deteriorate, sometimes blood vessels will grow up through them and break and bleed. That's the wet type. There is a therapy, and there has been one for a while now, these injections into the eye that counteract those abnormal blood vessels, and they can cause them to dry up and regress. But you then always have the forest fire behind it, right? So dry, there right now, there really isn't anything that we can do for dry. Wet, we have the ability to at least reduce it back to the dry level. That's a huge part of what we're doing in the Institute. So it's a major focus of the Institute. And we're looking at it in multiple different ways. One would be medications to slow that down, nutrition that can help prevent it or slow it down as well. And then also the idea of replacing the parts that are replacing the trees, so to speak. The parts that are worn out in macular degeneration. And so and there's actually two parts that get worn out in macular degeneration, making it a little more complex, but we can make both parts. We can make them in high quantity and high quality. And now we're working towards clinical trials to be able to work with patients.
And Connie, thanks so much for calling. How many different projects do you have going on at the McPherson?
It's almost
even know.
Yeah, I couldn't even tell you. And it's fluid, of course, right? So We're not static. It's not like, you know, there was an issue 10 years ago and we're going to, you know, we're just working with that. We have over 180 different members in the Institute at the UW-Madison. We have probably 60 or more laboratories, individual laboratories, and it spans the entire gamut of disease in the eye and visual system. So from glaucoma to diabetic retinopathy to macular degeneration, retinitis pigmentosa. But importantly, we're much more than just, you know, we're biologists and clinicians, but we're not just that either. We also reach out to engineers and physicists and mathematicians and psychologists. We have people building machines to look at the individual cells in a living patient's retina, so we can see what's going on in real time in live patients, and maybe even look inside of cells, so we can really get a sense of what's going on with folks that are having these devastating diseases. So there's really nothing that isn't that we can't engage if it means helping patients obtain a good therapy.
Well, it's wonderful work, and I'm thinking about funding. And I know one of the ways that you raise some money for your work is the Cycle for Sight. We'll talk about that for a minute or two.
Yeah, this is our eighth year. We really started it. We didn't know exactly how far it would go. We knew we wanted to keep our overhead really, really low. So it had to be something fun. It had to be something I wanted to do. But we thought, you know, even if it's not, you know, hugely successful financially, which it really has become, which has been great, it was important for awareness. And we wanted to engage folks who had low vision or blindness in our community and their relatives or folks that had an interest in it. And we wanted to do something that was very inclusive and just basically told people what we were doing here in their own backyard. Because you'd be surprised how often, you know, people don't know what's going on right down the street and how world-class that it is. So we started it off that way, and we got riding teams, and it was just really, it was a lot of fun and raised awareness. But it's grown since then, and we're, this is our eighth year, and we should eclipse about $250,000 total raised. And that all goes to vision research at the McPherson Eye Research Institute here at UW-Madison. And it helps to augment the types of things that we've been talking about today.
So people get on bikes and...
Yep, it's a spinning. So we have three locations, the Natatorium, Princeton Club, and Capital Fitness. And it's a week from this Saturday, so the 9th. The website is visionsave.wisc.edu. You can sign up for yourself or your friends. It's a stationary biking because it's winter. It gives an opportunity for folks to get out of their house and work up a little bit of a sweat and get together with some fun people. They don't have to cycle either.
No.
Like Princeton Club, you can walk around the track. I mean, we're pretty inclusive. We're not going to turn anybody away. If you want to do jumping jacks for sight, we're happy with that too. So, but it's a really good time. I enjoy it. And it's ride at your own pace. You know, it's...
And you don't have to. You can just donate too.
You too. Yes, absolutely. There are folks. The past few years, we've had people who couldn't be here because they were in other countries, and they had a spontaneous Cycle for Sight in Myanmar and Madrid. We love that. We just ask for fake pictures. Send us photos.
So it's at our the site is also at wpr.org/Larry. You can go on the right side, and you get a click to it's visionsave.wisc.edu?
Yes.
visionsave.wisc.edu. And you can just make a contribution there or sign up.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a fun time.
Oh, I enjoy it.
Well, we have more callers online. Marge in La Crosse has something for us. Let's go there. Marge, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just have a real quick question. I've noticed it seems like less kids are having to wear glasses when they're younger. I'm 61. My husband's 63. We started wearing glasses when we were like 10 or 12. And our children are in their 30s. They don't wear glasses. My grandchildren don't wear glasses. Is this dietary or some other reason?
No, you're just lucky. So your family's lucky. So we're not seeing trends for refractive errors, whether that be nearsightedness or farsightedness or what have you. Not seeing trends of those improving over time. I mean, the way that we address them changes sometimes. We see more people wearing contact lenses and what have you. So you may not see as many people wearing glasses because there are other alternatives. I'm nearsighted. My wife's nearsighted. We have two kids that are nearsighted, one that isn't. So this is one of those things where it's potentially just, you know, it's fortunate that they didn't have to, or and it depends on how severe your refractive error is too, because if you have mild impairments, then you can get by.
There we go, Marge. Thanks a lot. Steve emailed, has a 16-year-old niece diagnosed with acanthamoeba.
Is okay.
That, and she's been experiencing extreme light sensitivity, constant pain. They're currently, he doesn't think there are any effective treatments or known ones. However, she's gone to a hospital in Miami where there is apparently one doctor with a new treatment. Is there anything you know about that or other treatments? Or information about this protozoan infection?
Yeah, so acanthamoeba is a rare infection of the cornea. It's a parasite. It's an amoeba, and you get it through. One of the common ways to do it is hot tubs. All right, So that's why you always want to make sure you keep your hot tubs clean, and you don't want to be opening your eyes underneath the water. But generally, that's the mechanism whereby people get it. And it can be very aggressive, and it can be hard to diagnose at first. So it's not unusual for people to initially be treated like it was a bacterial infection, but typical antibiotics are not going to help, or maybe a viral infection, but antivirals don't work in that case. And so oftentimes, it's recognized a little bit on the late side. But there are medications, there are drugs that directly combat the amoeba. So there are effective treatments. The problem is that if you get to it late, or if it's a particularly aggressive infection, it can leave scarring. And if it leaves scarring, then you have trouble, because once that cornea, that clear dome, is opaque, then there's really no way to reverse that scarring. But you can remove the cornea and put a new one on. It's a corneal transplant. But that's kind of a last resort that people try to. First, you have to get on top of the infection itself. So the different treatments generally still are based on drugs that try to kill the amoeba itself, or the inflammation that it causes.
So where would Steve's niece, if she lives in Wisconsin, where would she come to you guys?
Yes, that's typically, you know, an acanthamoeba infection is a pretty severe thing, so you'd want to go to a tertiary care facility and a large ophthalmology department, and that's something that our cornea specialists here at the University of Wisconsin Department of Ophthalmology deal with on a not infrequent basis, and so we're well equipped to address that here in Wisconsin.
We have Carla from Carmel, California, online. Hi, Carla.
Happy to talk to you. Say, about 5 years ago, I suddenly lost a lot of my eyesight in my left eye. It was like overnight, and it was quite a lot. I, of course, saw several ophthalmologists, and no one could really figure out what it was. Then 2 years ago, I had my cataracts, I had my cataracts removed.
Yeah.
And sure enough, and that was wonderful, you know, because suddenly it was fine again. And the left eye is my reading eye. In any case, my weak eye. Doggone it if it didn't happen again. And it was a smaller stroke this time, but I sort of think of it as a stroke. I have no idea what it is. Just curious if you have any concept about sudden loss of eyesight.
I think you're on the right track. The most common cause of just an acute pain, it was painless, right?
Yep.
It was painless, and your eye didn't look any different, right? It wasn't red. It was just normal everyday day, and just couldn't see out of the eye. So most of the time, that is what we call a stroke in the eye. So the retina itself has multiple blood vessels to it, and it can get they can get clogged. And the retina is a part of the brain. It's a very specialized part of the brain, but it's a part of the brain. So it can get a stroke just like your brain can. And so a couple of things can happen with that. One would be that it just kind of chokes the retina from its oxygen supply, and then it dies, that portion of it at least. Or sometimes you can dam up the blood supply from getting back from the eye to your general circulatory system, and that can cause an acute loss of vision too. Typically, though, in those cases, they're not hard to diagnose. There's very straightforward diagnostic tests that can be done that reveal what the cause was, and once you have one, you're at higher risk for having another one, just like you would in a cerebral stroke. And so the typical things that we look at when people have a history of that would be, make sure you don't have sleep apnea. People with sleep apnea have a higher risk of that. making sure that you're being treated if you have plaques in your carotid arteries that might be breaking off and causing these strokes in the eye, which can also cause strokes in the brain. So a really thorough workup by your primary care doctor in conjunction with your ophthalmologist and maybe another specialist cardiologist is important.
There we go. Good luck. Thank you so much, Carla, for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give Krista in Sussex a chance to join us. Hi, Krista.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure thing. What's on your mind?
Well, I was curious. My mother was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa
about
20 years ago.
Yeah.
Her vision is pretty much nothing at this point. Are there any clinical trials that she would be eligible for, or...
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. So the answer is it depends. So first of all, retinitis pigmentosa is an inherited disorder. So your mother was born with it. So you said that she was diagnosed recently, but this is something typically that if it truly is retinitis pigmentosa, you start to lose your peripheral vision, your night vision in your late single digits or teenage years. And then ultimately it can cause a very severe narrowing of your vision and complete blindness sometimes too. And it is passed along in families, not always in every generation, but it can be passed along. There are about 100 or so different types of retinitis pigmentosa. Different genes,
wow,
when they're mutated, can cause different forms of retinitis pigmentosa. So 20 years ago, 30 years ago, you said, well, I had retinitis pigmentosa. Sort of like saying I have cancer, right?
Yeah.
There's a ton of different. So if you say, yeah, is there some sort of treatment? And the first question is, well, what kind of cancer do you have? So luckily now, due to work that's been done here at the McPherson Eye Research Institute as well as elsewhere, it matters. So you need to know what the gene defect is, because some of them have gene therapies, some of them have interventions or clinical trials going on right now. There's actually one FDA-approved trial or treatment for one type of retinitis pigmentosa, but that affects newborns. So that would not have been your mother. So it's important to see your ophthalmologist, get genetic testing done so that you know what type of retinitis pigmentosa you are. Now, I will say, though, that the work that we're doing at the Institute is trying to be agnostic towards that, so that the types of therapies that we're concentrating on, it doesn't really matter what the type of gene mutation that caused the retinitis pigmentosa that you had, but rather we're looking to replace the cells once they're lost. So we don't care how you got to where you are, we just want to fix you once you're there. So there are approaches that are both interested in that where you need to know the gene, and then hopefully there'll be some that are more broadly applicable where you don't.
So once Krista's mother determines that, would she contact the McPherson Eye Research?
She could certainly give us a call or an email, and then we'd be happy to direct her where to go. And as I said, the vast majority of folks, unfortunately, with RP do not have a therapy or even a clinical trial, and we're hoping to change that in the foreseeable future.
Oh. Krista, thanks so much for calling. Pam in Oregon, your turn. Hi, Pam.
Hi. I have a simple question. Can you do a total eye transplant?
That is a very good question. And I get it a lot because they say, do you want to donate your eyes, right? And so why would you donate your eyes if you can't put the eye back in? Just to put that aside, that really is for the cornea. So if you donate your eyes, it's very, very important that people do that. But that is to remove the cornea from the donated eyes and place it on somebody who has, say, the Fuchs dystrophy that we talked about earlier. So not too long ago, the idea of replacing a whole eyeball would be complete science fiction. And why is that? It's because that the eye is connected to the brain via the optic nerve. And the optic nerve has 1.2 million wires. And those wires connect individual cells in the retina to individual cells in the brain. And so if you just kind of cut that cable, and you can't kind of just stick a new one in there and expect all those wires to hook up again, right? However, it is now not in the realm of science fiction, and there are groups that are looking at ways in which that may occur. Now, we're not looking to erase all vestiges of eye disease, right, that you're going to have perfect vision after that, but right now it's just baby steps, right? Can you get an eye, can you put an eye back in, can it survive? Can you get it to, can the blood vessels reconnect so that it just doesn't immediately die? And then after that, can you get some of those 1.2 million wires to perhaps communicate with one another and provide light or dark or that sort of thing?
Wow.
So it's an interesting question. The answer is no for right now, but it's amazing that there are efforts to look into that now.
Well, that is absolutely amazing, and a lot of the research done at the McPherson, well, all of it, frankly, is amazing to me. The McPherson Eye Research Institute, Dr. David Gamm, directs it. Just a reminder, the annual Cycle for Sight event is March 9th, but you could go online right now if you wanted to make a contribution or get involved. You'd go to visionsave.wisc.edu. Or go to WPR.org/Larry, and just over on the right side, you're going to see a spot where you can click on that same site. Dr. Gamm, it's always such a pleasure, and even though you deal with a lot of problems, it's uplifting to know that we're working so hard to solve, and have solved many.
Oh, yeah. Love coming on and talk. I don't have to chart anything. Don't have to build anything. It's great.
Dr. David Gamm again, directing the McPherson Eye Research Institute. We'll have him back, and we'll talk with him again for sure. It's always a pleasure to visit with Dr. Gamm. Well, coming up, we are going to switch gears and talk with an author. You may be looking for a good book to read, and I think I've got one for you. Bill Stokes is the author, and we'll talk with him next about his latest novel. It's called Margaret's War. That next on the Ideas Network.